about what the Bible would say about our responsibility to each other in the body, our responsibility in regards to each other's spiritual welfare. In other words, the issue of offense. Now, I'd like to look at about 23 verses with you. Before you leave, go to the restroom and not come back, which would be the right thing, wrong thing to do. What I like to do is to comment as we go. I think that will save time instead of reading and then trying to go back and flush some of the issues out and then make some application at the end. So it might be helpful to find this in your Bible if you have it there in the pew or on. I would tell you to find it on your phone, but you know, I don't want to raise the temptation that you might watch the game. I only know about that temptation because I would have that temptation if I were you. All right. And the words will be on your screen. So beginning in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, there's an issue that surfaces that raises the bigger issue of our responsibility to each other. And in verse 1 of chapter 8, it says, "Now concerning things offered to idols." You understand that in the book of Corinthians, this is really a letter that Paul is writing to them, and actually a series of letters. There's at least three letters, although we only have two here. But they're asking him questions, and he's responding to the questions that they're asking. And they have asked him what to do about things or foods sacrificed to idols. Now, that's a small issue to you and I, and we would look at that issue and say, what's the big deal? That's not very important. But for them, it was an extremely important issue. Because in the ancient world, you had temples, and people would worship at these temples. And in the ancient world, you had many, many gods. In fact, when Paul comes to Athens in Acts chapter 17, he talks about how it's overrun with gods. There's gods everywhere, and then finally he sees a statue to the unknown god and begins to talk about that unknown god. But there were gods everywhere, and there were temples built to those gods everywhere. And if you came to the faith from a non-Jewish background, you almost certainly came to the faith from a pagan background. In other words, you grew up worshiping in these pagan temples. You worshiped the false gods of the Jews and then the Romans. Now, in each of these temples, they would sacrifice animals to their gods. And very seldom would all the animal be sacrificed. Usually it was just a token part of the animal. The largest part of the animal was then taken and it was either sold in the temple meat market, and you could buy it there and the funds would help support the temple, or there might be a temple restaurant. If you wanted a good steak, you could go down to the Midas restaurant there at the temple restaurant and you could have a steak. And so a vast amount of the meat in those pagan temples had actually been sacrificed to the pagan gods. And so if you wanted a good steak in that town and you were visiting, you almost would have to eat a piece of meat that had been offered up to one of the gods. Now, when it was offered up, there was significance there. In fact, Paul will later say in chapter 10, he said, you have to understand that when we do the Lord's Supper, the bread is broken, and we say, this is the body of Christ broken for you. And then when the Welch's grape juice is poured out there, we say, this is the blood of the new covenant shed for you for the remission of sins. And so, it's bread, it's juice, but it's just not bread and juice to us. It's symbolic in nature. We've offered it up. There's a holiness to it. And you can think of what might happen in one of those pagan temples. And here you are, you've grown up in this pagan temple, and it's a temple that's say to Midas. And so there's the meat, You put it on the altar, and then maybe everybody takes a small part of the meat, and it's part of eating this meat as part of your worship. The other part will go to be sold. But in eating the meat, the priest will say, "This is the body of Midas." And as we eat this meat, we recognize that Midas supplies all of our needs, and we are swearing allegiance, or we're giving the due respect of Midas. We offer this up to Midas, bless this Midas, and we recognize that Midas supplies all of our needs. We eat the meat. And then the rest of that meat goes to the temple. Temple restaurant or meat market to be sold. If you grow up in that atmosphere, the question is, what do you do about all this meat? And again, it's a significant issue because you couldn't get a good steak in that town unless you raised it yourself, which was unlikely, or you bought it from the meat market. So Paul is talking about this, and he says, now concerning the stuff offered to idols, we know that we have all knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Now, he's saying here, none of us are stupid. We all have knowledge. We all have an opinion on this issue. You think you know something. I think I know something. But let's talk about love for a moment. Let's get out of talking about what's right and wrong, and let's at least program our minds as we think about this issue of the meat to talk about what's the loving thing to do. Because knowledge puffs up, knowledge makes proud, but love edifies, or love builds the other one up. And so that's what we want to think about. Not what's particularly black and white, but what is the loving thing to do. Now he says in verse 4 and 6, 4 through 6, he says, therefore, concerning the eating of the things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom all things, and we for Him, and our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. Now he says, in principle, there's only one God. We're talking about what's true. And they may be offering up food to these idols, but we know those idols are nothing. There's only one God. And so the meat being offered to these so-called idols, the idols are nothing. So there's really no consecration happening in regards to the meat because there's no God to consecrate the meat. So a steak's a steak. It doesn't mean anything. There aren't any gods but one. It says verse 7 though, however, there is not in everyone this knowledge. For some, with consciousness of the idol until now, eat as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. So he says, technically, it's black and white. It's not an issue because it's not meat sacrificed to a god because those aren't gods. He said, but everyone doesn't know that. He said, essentially, if you grow up in that situation, that meat that's been offered up has been consecrated, and if you eat the meat, that would be worship to that God, because eating the meat would, in that context, was a part of their worship to that God. And so, for them, it makes a difference. For you, a steak's a steak. But for them, a steak is an offering to the God. Okay. He said, so verse 9, but beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? In other words, you know a steak's a steak. But if they think a steak is a sacrifice, and they see you eating meat down at the Midas restaurant, they're walking by, you're in there eating, they're going to look at you and say, oh, I didn't realize that you could worship Jesus and Midas at the same time. And so you're going to lead them back into the worship of that false god. Because you know it's just a steak, but they don't know it's a steak. And so you'll mislead them into abandoning the worship of Christ solely into a form of polytheism. And so in verse 11, he says, and because of your knowledge, now you're right, he says, you're right, a steak's just a steak. But because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound the weak conscience, you sin against Christ. You sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat again, lest I make my brother stumble. So he says, steak's a steak, but if you eat the steak, and somebody sees you eat the steak and he says, oh, it's okay to worship Midas. And he goes back into worshiping Midas because that's a form of worship to him. You've sinned against him and you've sinned against Christ in eating that piece of steak. Now, in chapter 10, verse 23 through 33, Paul begins to work out some of the particulars then of what the people ought to do about eating the steak. And you'll notice he doesn't say, don't eat it. And he doesn't say, eat it. He says, whether or not you eat, it depends. It's not a diaper, it depends. He says, all things are lawful to me. Verse 23, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. I should say here that in Hebrew and Greek, there aren't quotation marks. And so when you come to the Bible, oftentimes things we see in quotation marks, we know that's a quote because it was a verse in the Old Testament. In the King James Version and the New King James Version, the editors chose not to add quotation marks, whereas other versions do. And I would just point out that in verse 23, there's a quote there, and then in verse 24 that the other translations note. And the quote is, all things are lawful for me. In other words, Paul's quoting them. Paul isn't saying all things are lawful for me. They're saying, quote unquote, all things are lawful for me. And then Paul responds and says, but all things aren't helpful. And then they say, quote unquote, all things are lawful for me again. And then Paul responds by saying, yeah, but all things don't build up. All things don't edify. And so they're arguing, well, I can eat whatever I want. And Paul's saying, yeah, but all things aren't helpful and all things don't edify. And so if it's not helpful and if it doesn't edify, you go back to chapter 8. It's really a sin against that person and a sin against Christ. Now, in verse 25 through 30, watch carefully what Paul does. Because there's three situations that occur here. In verse 25, he says, okay, now let me get very practical. He says, eat whatever is sold in the meat market asking no questions for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. If any of those who do not believe invites you to dinner, and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. Now, get that. He says, meat's nothing. Steak's a steak. So, if you go down to the meat market, buy the steak. If you get it at a good price, go ahead and buy it. Take it home. Don't ask where it came from. Don't ask, don't tell. Just buy the steak. It's a good deal. Buy the steak. And then in verse 27, he says, and if somebody invites you to dinner, they invite you to come to eat with them, go and don't ask where they got the steak from. Don't ask if you bought it at the Temple of Midas. Leave it alone. Leave it alone. If you were to put this in maybe a contemporary setting, what Paul is saying is don't spend the Christmas Eve party at your neighbor's trying to figure out if there's real rum in the fruitcake. Don't do that. The dessert comes out. Could be rum flavor. It could be rum. But eat it. Don't ask what's in it. Don't ask where it came from. Unless, verse 28. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience sake, for the earth is the fullness, for the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? But if I partake with thanks, why am I evil spoken of for the food over which I gave thanks? Now, notice there in 28. He says, if you go down to the temple or wherever else, there's a meat market, buy the meat, don't ask where it came from. If you go to somebody's house and they put meat in front of you, eat it and don't try to embarrass the host. Don't embarrass them. Don't ask, hey, where'd you get the meat from? Leave it alone. Unless you're at their house, you're at this dinner party, and a Christian leans over to you and says, hey, Nathan, I know you're a Christian. I know you wouldn't worship an idol. And I just got to tell you that I saw where they bought the meat today. They bought it down at the Temple of Midas. If you get told where it came from, then don't eat it. Don't ask where it came from, Paul says. But if you get told by another Christian, then don't eat it. Stick to the salad. So in other words, if you're there on the Christmas Eve party, they bring out the fruitcake. Don't ask if it's rum flavored or if there's rum in it. But if somebody leans over to you and says, hey, Sandy, she just doesn't put rum flavoring in it. She baptizes it in rum. And I'd be careful about what you're about to eat. If you get told, say, I'm just going to stick to the coffee. And it looks nice, but I'm just going to stick to coffee tonight. Now, you notice that. Don't ask where it came from when you buy it. Don't ask where it came from when it's put in front of you. Don't embarrass your host. Don't start a big thing. Don't ask him where it came from. Don't get into that. You're a guest. You've been invited. Be kind. Be generous. Unless somebody whispers to you, say, and says, hey, I'll tell you where the meat came from. If you get told, then don't eat the meat. Does Paul sound like a hypocrite there, you think? I don't know. Verse 31. He says, therefore, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. Now, let me point out two or three things here. In the first place, this passage is talking about a weak Christian, not an immature Christian. And sometimes this passage gets applied in regards to immature Christians. It's interesting when Paul first goes to the Jews, and the Jews haven't really heard about Jesus, and he's going and he's trying to win some Jewish converts. In Acts chapter 16, he takes Timothy, who's Greek, and he tells him that he needs to be circumcised, because if he's not circumcised, it's going to be a problem when they go to the Jews. And so he circumcises Timothy in Acts 16. You come to the book of Galatians, and in Galatians chapter 5, and this is several years later, Paul tells them, don't be circumcised, don't allow the Jews to circumcise you, because of what it will mean to the Jews. And he's very hard, and he's saying, don't allow anybody to circumcise you. Don't allow that to happen. And the difference is that in Acts 16, they're going and they're trying to win new converts. And this is going to be a problem, and we don't want this to be a stumbling block for them. But in Galatians, those are Christians who should know better. Those people have been in the church for years. They ought to know that circumcision doesn't mean anything with God. And so Paul says, I'm not going to cave to those who have been in the church for a while. And it's time that they grow up. It's time they put down their false doctrine and get some real doctrine. But for those who may be weak coming into the faith, I'm willing not to put a stumbling block in front of them. This is for weak Christians. This is not for Christians who perpetually complain. There are weak Christians, and they need to be cared for. You don't need to put a stumbling block in front of them. But there are other people who have been around the church long enough that they need to be told that they need to grow up. This is about weak Christians, not immature Christians. Notice secondly, and this is just a principle, that the weak Christian is more likely to get offended than the strong Christian. Notice this. He says, now you strong Christians, you're the ones who understand the issue of meat, that it's nothing. The weak Christians are those who would get offended and hurt and damaged if they saw you eating this meat. And you need to care for these weak Christians. In principle, the weak Christians are the ones who are easily offended. And, you know, it's interesting in the church sometimes, the people who pass for strong Christians are the ones who get offended all the time. I mean, I can remember growing up, and it seemed like for some that the strong Christian was the one who was very conscientious and got mad if you did anything wrong. And they were constantly being offended. And they were the ones who were constantly offended about the way somebody looked, the fact that somebody went here, the fact that somebody did this, the fact that somebody was asked to do this and not them. And they were constantly offended. And that passed for a strong conscience. It's not. To be constantly offended, to be constantly angry, to be constantly mad, to be constantly nitpicking, to be constantly at odds with people is a sign of a weak Christian, not a strong one. We went down to Florida fishing a few days ago. I had rented the car, and it was supposed to be a Nissan Versa or the equivalent. And so I'm going into the car lot, the Hertz area there, where the cars are parked, and with my three compadres, and it's like we keep walking, and it dawned on me, I'm counting it because it's in slot 5, and it's like, oh no, it's the Cube. And it was a Kia Soul. You know, and after you know, after driving it, Kia Souls are great. I would recommend a Kia Soul. But, you know, it's this car that for, you know, seemed like years, the commercial was those hamsters driving it. And it's like, oh, wow, I got to drive a Kia Soul. And, you know, the guys are ragging. It's not even a Kia Soul that blends in. It's a red one. And so it's like, oh, wow. And, but here's the thing. It's a small car. And I'm just guessing because we drove through some storm and wind there. You can feel the storm and wind in a Kia Soul. Oh, I don't know if you can in a heavy-duty pickup truck, but a Kia Soul is sort of a weak car. And a weak car gets easily offended. It gets moved around by the stuff going on around it. We went fishing on three different boats, and in the first day we went fishing on a boat that was probably, I don't know, 70, 80 feet long. And when you're in a 70, 80-foot boat, it traverses across the waves pretty easily. The last day we went out on a boat that was probably 20 feet, and you feel waves in a 20-foot boat you don't feel in a big boat. And the point is that the 20-foot boat is sort of weak. And the weaker something is, the more it's tossed and turned around by what's going on outside of it. That tends to be the nature of something that's weak. And a weak Christian is a Christian who's constantly being offended. They're constantly looking around, and they're constantly losing their joy and on the verge of losing their salvation. Listen, a strong Christian is a Christian who is growing in consciousness, but they're also growing in faith and joy. And if you're a strong Christian, you not only have a strong conscience, but you also have a strong joy that doesn't get robbed when people do things around you that you may or may not like. You have a faith that sort of glides through this situation. And again, the strong Christian here is the one who doesn't care all that much about the meat issue. The weak Christian is the one saying, I don't know, look at those people. Can you believe that they'd eat at a place like, I can't believe that they would eat at a place. Can you, and look how they were dressed when they were eating at that place. Come on! And they lose their joy. They're like this Kia Soul, man. It'd be a pickup truck. And so, again, the principle here is that the stronger you are in the faith, the less the doings and the going-ons in the lives of other Christians affect you. See, oftentimes, people say, well, what they did offended me. Can't believe they would do that. I stayed up all night thinking about what they did. Can you believe? I not only stayed up all night, I called four different people and told them what they did. I thought about putting it on Facebook. I was that offended. And it seems like people never crosses their mind, maybe I shouldn't be offended. Maybe it's a sign that I'm sort of weak. My joy is that small. My contentment is that wobbly that the word they said or the thing they did can rob me of my joy. That's a pretty small joy you got going on there. Again, a strong Christian is the one that isn't affected by the waves and the wind around it. The weak Christian is the one who is. Again, you need to be a strong Christian. Having said that, I want you to see that Paul, this is really important, as he is striving to discern what to do on this issue, which is a big issue to them, what he wants to do is to protect two weak individuals, not just one. He wants to take this weak convert and he wants to behave in such a way that they don't fall away. But he also wants to protect the integrity of the faith and not offend the non-Christian individual. You see that? Because he says, if you go to the market, buy the meat, don't ask where it came from. If you go to somebody's house, don't ask them where they got the meat. In other words, don't offend your host. Don't do that. Care about your host. Don't start a discussion about that. They're non-Christian. And the context here is that you would be invited into a Greek home or a Gentile home. And you need to love them. And don't mess up their party. Don't do that. Remember what, and by the way, that's a principle that applies in many things Paul would say. Remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 where Paul's talking about worship. And he gets to this issue of spiritual gifts and in particular tongues. And he says, listen, this is verse 23. He says, listen, if you guys all speak in tongues, when people from the outside come into your midst, they're going to think you're crazy. You don't believe that's in the Bible, do you? Verse 23, Corinthians 14, 23. He says, verse 23, therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speaks in tongues, and there comes in those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you are out of your mind? Paul is saying there on the issue of worship is we want the Spirit to have His way, but it's also important what people who are not in the church think about people in the church. And if you do that, they're going to come in and say they are bat crazy. So don't do it. Now what Paul again is doing here with the meat issue is the same principle. He's saying, if you go to a non-believer's house, love them. Care about their party. Care about their feelings. Don't start some crazy conversation and embarrass them and ruin their party. Leave it alone. Unless there's a believer there and they tell you, hey, you know, where they got the meat. And in that case, you're going to have to stick to the salad and you're going to have to care about this weak believer. What Paul would like to see done is for the weak believer to be cared for while not appearing to be unkind or unloving to non-believers. That's the solution he's trying to find. And again, you know, I've grown up around in the Church of God my whole life, and so I've been around, you know, a lot of the conversations that came out of the Church of God. And it seems like sometimes we've erred along the way, I grew up at a time around people who were very, very conscientious about how people ought to dress, about how much jewelry a person should wear, and all of those kinds of things. And they were wonderful people. And what they wanted to do was take a person who, you know, dressed wildly inappropriate and drew bad attention to themselves. And because they drew bad attention to themselves in the way that they dressed, they were constantly being tempted. They were Jezebel and that kind of thing. And they wanted to sort of bring them out of that. But in bringing them out, they ended up doing things that made unbelievers think they were crazy. That they're trying to bring a person out of this place that they would consider a sin and get them where they were more modest and where they weren't so flaunting with their appearance and get them sort of in that kind of place. But you know, I spent some time around folks who had such a problem with, you know, gold and pearls and all that's in the Bible. We looked at that and the wearing of expensive things and they wanted to get people not wearing expensive apparel and all of that so much that they said, well, listen, let's just do away with all jewelry, even wedding rings. Let's not do anything with wedding rings. And so they would take a woman and say, you know, all jewelry's out, even the wedding ring. And of course, when a woman takes off her wedding ring, goes home to her husband, he thinks she's crazy. He thinks she's thinking about cheating. And so in trying to fix the situation, it looks sort of silly to those on the outside. You know, one of the things that I grew up around was the issue of dancing. That was a big deal in the Church of God. There's an old saying in the Church of God that we used to preach against premarital sex because it might lead to dancing. That's how much we cared about dancing. And so you would try to win people out of the nightclub scene, and so we were hard on dancing and the party scene and that kind of thing, and dancing was out, and oftentimes we got to the place where we couldn't tell the difference in twerking on the dance floor, very sexually suggestive dancing, and a father dancing with his bride with his daughter on her wedding day. And so dancing was out, and people would look at us and say, you're almost anti-family, aren't you? I mean, you're against a father dancing with his daughter on her wedding day. There's a way in which you try to fix the problem, or we've tried to fix the problem at times, and we haven't found the solution because we fixed one side of the problem, but along the way, we've looked awful to non-believers. I guess that's what I'm saying, and maybe not so clearly. But Paul is trying to come down on this issue and say, we want to preserve this individual. We want to help them with their spirituality. We don't want to mislead them. We don't want them to be misguided. And at the same time, if we can do it, we don't want to look crazy to people who are watching us outside of the church. If we can pull that off, that's what we want to do. Now, if you can't pull that off, you have to err on the side of the weak Christian. And that's what he's saying. If you're at the dinner table, and now you're in a situation where it's either offend my host by not eating what's in front of me, or hurting this weak Christian, I'm afraid I'm going to have to offend my host and protect this weak Christian. If I have to choose, I'm going to have to go with the side of the weak Christian. Whatever I do, I cannot do anything that would hinder the walk of a person who has committed their life to Christ. I not only sin against them, Paul would say, if I hinder a person's walk by misleading them in any way and by making it harder for them to serve the Lord, or by misleading them in a way that they would go back to a lifestyle that they had walked away from, I not only sin against them, but I also sin against the Christ, the Jesus Christ who saved them. I have to be aware of that. All right. Amen. Stand with me.